It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. 23 states plus the District of Columbia have approved cannabis for medical use. Efforts to expand access to medical marijuana failed in the Iowa legislature this year. The legislation would have allowed Iowans with a range of health problems to obtain medical marijuana. Conditions including cancer, multiple sclerosis, Crohn's disease, post-traumatic stress disorder, and some other chronic and debilitating ailments would have also allowed up to four producers to grow marijuana in Iowa with oversight from state officials, also allowed independent dispensaries to sell the drug. This hour, we want to look at the question, does medical marijuana work? It's a question palliative care physician Dr. David Kasaret wanted to answer for his patients. Does it have medical value? Is it safe, or at least as safe as other drugs a doctor might prescribe? What are the risks? In his new book, Stoned, A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana, Dr. Kasaret sets out to find evidence of marijuana's medical potential. Dr. Kasaret joins us live for the hour. Welcome.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
I want to mention that you are a tenured professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. We want to reach out to our listeners this hour. What questions do you have about the science of marijuana, its effects on our brains, on our bodies? Do you have a medical condition that you think has been helped by using marijuana? 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Before we get to your evaluation based on your research of medical benefits in certain areas, start off, please, doctor, by giving us the basics of how marijuana works in our brains.
Sure. So the short story is that we don't have receptors in our brains or the rest of our bodies that are designed for medical marijuana. What we have are receptors that are designed to react to what are known as endocannabinoids or cannabinoid molecules that occur in the body as natural neurotransmitters. One of the most famous, probably because it has a great name, is anandamide, which translated from Sanskrit means the bliss molecule, discovered by Bill Devane and Raphael Meshulam in Jerusalem at Hebrew University. And that system of neurotransmitters like anandamide exists in all of our bodies, in all of us, and marijuana works when it works by tricking the body into thinking that the molecules in marijuana, which look like anandamide and others, really are. So it's a way of hacking into the body's system. And the two molecules in marijuana that have been studied the most are THC and CBD. So THC is tetrahydrocannabinol, CBD is cannabidiol. Of those two, it's THC that has the brain effects that we usually associate with marijuana. That's what makes you confused, feel goofy, feel euphoric, feel high. CBD, on the other hand, doesn't have any of those effects. It's worth noting, just for completeness, that there are a lot of cannabinoids out there. There are dozens that are present in marijuana, and there are probably more than 100 synthetic cannabinoids out there now. THC and CBD are present in the largest amounts in marijuana, so we know the most about them and we've studied them the most, but there really are a lot out there that we're just beginning to figure out.
Mm-hmm. As I mentioned, the legislation to increase access here in Iowa failed. I mentioned the range of problems that it would have allowed to be addressed by medical marijuana. What, and you looked at various ailments, diseases that might or might not be helped by medical marijuana. What's at the top of the list for the ailments, diseases that medical marijuana does seem to help and has a good scientific basis for doing so?
Sure. So probably the two conditions, for my money, that have the best evidence to support them are neuropathic pain, which is pain that's due to a nerve injury. So unlike arthritis pain or pain due to a broken bone, this is actually pain that's caused by damage to the nerve itself. That could be damage that's traumatic after an accident. It could be damage that's caused through metabolic processes like diabetes. People develop neuropathic pain. I just got an email a few minutes ago from a woman who was suffering from neuropathic pain after cancer chemotherapy due to the chemotherapy itself and other rheumatologic conditions. There's actually pretty good evidence now that marijuana is effective in treating that kind of pain. The other best category of evidence, again, from what I've seen, is for nausea, particularly nausea after chemotherapy, but maybe other forms of nausea as well. It may not work as well as other treatments that are first-line treatments for nausea chemotherapy, like ondansetron, but as a second or third-line treatment for people who aren't responding to those first-line treatments, the data seem to be pretty good. There are other uses, too, like insomnia, loss of appetite, that it's been used for, and there's some data there as well. But those first two, nausea and neuropathic pain, are so distressing to so many people, those are usually the indications that I would recommend that somebody might at least think about it.
Mm-hmm. Brian on our Facebook page says, as an Iowan diagnosed with Crohn's disease 15 years ago, I would love to see medical marijuana. I can legally access medical cannabis in 24 states. What is Iowa's malfunction? Well, that other point is more a political question, but what about Crohn's disease?
Yeah, we don't really know. And whenever I say that, I have to preface what I say. When I say we don't know whether it works, that means it doesn't. That doesn't mean it doesn't work. What it means is we just haven't done those studies yet. And it's important to realize that we have very little, relatively little data on the effectiveness of medical marijuana. So there are a lot of uses. Crohn's disease, for instance, PTSD would be another one for which people are using it, I think, fairly commonly. And many people believe it works. We just don't have the evidence yet. We may get the evidence at some point. We just don't have it. There is, though, at least with Crohn's disease, some theoretical reasons to think that it might work. And I'm not getting into treatment recommendations here. This is more theory. But we know that CBD in particular has receptors on immune cells. And we know that a lot of what goes on in Crohn's is an autoimmune phenomenon where the immune system gets revved up and begins to react to normal tissues. We also know there's a lot of immune tissue, meaning white blood cells, in the GI tract. So there are people out there, researchers, who are thinking that if there's any condition that CBD in particular might be effective for, Crohn's disease might be pretty close to the top of the list. So I have not seen any randomized controlled trials yet, but at least there's theoretical reason to be very interested.
I failed to mention what Iowa law is regarding cannabis oil right now. You can possess some cannabis oil with a correct medical card. I believe it's been reported that the cannabis oil program here in Iowa has cost more than $100,000 to create and issue registration cards to about 50 people. But you can't access it in the state, Dr. Kasaret. I don't know how much you've looked at Iowa's situation here. It's illegal to bring it across state borders into the state, and there's no place that produces it. So it's been criticized as largely useless, the law that we have so far.
I know a little bit about it. I also know, I think, and please tell me if I'm incorrect, that when you say cannabis oil, it's actually cannabidiol oils,
yes.
CBD oil.
Yes, without the high-giving THC element.
Exactly. And that's always been mysterious to me, that anybody would even bother to regulate CBD oil. It has no psychological effects whatsoever. May have medical benefits. But certainly has none of the effects that THC does. And you know, there are those who argue that it shouldn't be regulated at all. It really has no more risk associated with it than, say, ibuprofen. So to go to those lengths, I don't know what the rationale was, but to go to those lengths to regulate something, especially in a way that makes it possible to have it but not to obtain it, especially for a drug that's as apparently harmless as CBD, doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense.
Now, our NPR listeners would have heard a new study, a report on a new study in the Journal of American the Medical Association, raising questions about safety and effectiveness. I don't know if you've looked at this. This is where researchers from the University of Bristol in the United Kingdom reviewed some findings from 79 different studies looking at the effect of marijuana on some symptoms ranging from chronic pain, sleep difficulties, you've mentioned mental illness. Well, the conclusion, at best, they found only moderate evidence indicating that marijuana reduced nerve pain and pain from cancer. And when it came to other conditions, nausea, vomiting due to chemotherapy, difficulty sleeping, weight loss among HIV patients. There was merely, they came to the conclusion, anecdotal evidence suggesting that people may be helped by marijuana. Your reaction?
I think that study was both well done and its interpretation has been fascinating. It's important for that study to read the fine print. And if you actually go, so I'm just curious, did you look to see what criteria they used to rate the quality of studies?
No, I didn't dig into it that far.
You didn't. I didn't at the first pass, and probably nobody else did either. If you actually look, as a colleague urged me to do, the criteria that they use to determine whether something, a study is, or evidence is strong, medium, or weak, are really pretty strict. So just to give you one example, they downgraded, they literally took points off from studies if studies were, as the UK folks put it, sparse. And what sparse meant was that they enrolled fewer than 200 patients. Well, remember, medical marijuana isn't legal for the federal government in the United States. There's no federal funding for marijuana. It's really, really hard to do large-scale studies of hundreds of people if you don't have federal funding. So with one criteria, they basically downgraded the quality of evidence of pretty much every marijuana study that's ever been done. And there are other criteria they used that were strict, too. So I'm not criticizing the criteria they used. In fact, if you're a really hardcore researcher or if you're a regulator at the Food and Drug Administration, you really want those tough criteria. And that's fair. I'm not arguing with that. On the other hand, if you're a patient who's tried three or four anti-nausea medications and you know there have been a couple of studies, they're small studies, they only enrolled 40 or 50 people, but they showed benefits, would that person who's suffering day in, day out with chemotherapy-related nausea, is she going to say, well, I know there have been a couple of studies, but they're only small studies, so I'll just wait and tough it out? No, I think most patients would say, okay, the data may not be great, it may not have proven benefits, but it's good enough for me to try. And I think where a lot of the debate in medical marijuana is right now is not what the evidence is, but it's more about how much evidence you need if you're somebody suffering through chemotherapy after initial treatment for lymphoma and you have nausea every day, or somebody who is suffering from PTSD after a very traumatic rape 2 years ago and you haven't been able to get any relief. How much evidence do you actually need? And they're very different perspectives on how much evidence is enough.
If you just joined us, Dr. David Kasseret is my guest live this hour, palliative care physician, also a researcher and a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine, and author of Stoned, A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana, in which he set out to find evidence of marijuana's medical potential, also to look at possible risks. We want to get to that for sure later in the hour. Let's go to our first caller, 1-866-780-9100. Aaron is joining us from Dallas Center, Iowa. Hi, Aaron.
Hello.
What's your connection to this topic?
Well, my son is 3 years old, and he has intractable epilepsy, a large symptomatic pineal cyst in his brain, and lots of other neurological issues with a genetic brain disorder and a rare chromosome disorder. And our neurologist actually suggested that we use CBD, which was a relief.
And have you been able to do that?
We have been unable to obtain a card here in Iowa. But we started it anyway. After we'd reached out to several lawmakers and told them our story, they told us that the law was kind of a gray area and to go ahead and try it. And we are on week three of using the medicine, and my son has seen huge improvements.
What kind of improvements? From where to where?
From having multiple absent seizures a day to only having two in 3 weeks. He started interactively playing with his toys for the first time ever, independently playing with his toys, sleeping, eating, and his therapists have noticed big changes where they have even said that it seems like his entire sensory system has been reset.
Aaron, you are a group of mothers who have been lobbying the legislature for changes in Iowa's law. Dr. Kasseret, you write about a child that you met, and the parents of this child, chronic seizures similar to this case, echoing it, correct?
Yeah, I think so. So that's the story of a girl in the book I call Randy, and I spent some time with her parents, Cal and Cindy. They were actually out, still are out in California and San Diego. Different pattern of symptoms, different kinds of seizures. Their seizures, Randy's seizures, were due to Dravet syndrome, but the same scenario of childhood seizures. And Cal told me that he had actually had trouble getting physicians and others to take her seizures, Randy's seizures, seriously. And he told me that having a child with this kind of seizure disorder is like having a child with cancer. It's just as devastating, but harder to treat. And they, like Aaron did, got access to, it sounds like had an easier time of getting access to oil that had high concentrations of cannabidiol or CBD and virtually no THC because they didn't want to expose her. And they had remarkable successes as well. So I'm glad that Aaron's story is going well. People should know that there is a randomized controlled trial going on run by a neurologist named Oren Davinsky, who's based at the New York University, NYU, the Epilepsy Center there. And this is a randomized controlled trial to begin to figure out in a rigorous way whether and how CBD oil helps. But I think there are many parents out there who are experiencing these sorts of results and convinced that it really does help their children.
Mm-hmm. Aaron, before we say goodbye, will you be continuing to lobby the Iowa legislature?
Absolutely.
All right.
It's important.
All right. We wish you the best, Aaron.
Thank you.
Aaron in Dallas Center. She dialed 1-866-780-9100. Dr. David Kasseret, author of Stoned, A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana, our guest this hour. 1-866-780-9100. Let's talk a little bit about the methods you point out in your book, besides smoking a joint, in which you can take in perhaps some beneficial aspects of marijuana. Which of the methods work best?
Well, I'm not sure there's really a best, actually. That's a perfect question to ask, but there's no easy answer. What works best, I think, depends on why people are using it and what people's preferences are. Certainly, the ways to get the active ingredients of marijuana into your system quickly are methods like smoking or vaporizing, which is a way of, as the name implies, a way of heating marijuana buds to a temperature that's above the temperature that cannabinoids like THC and CBD vaporize, but below the temperature at which the plant material starts to burn. So you're literally turning those molecules into vapor, inhaling them without all of the stuff that gets inhaled as smoke. That's a really good, efficient, very direct, very fast way of getting doses, if you will, of THC and CBD into your system. It doesn't last very long. It lasts as long as it stays in your system, but the release is very intense and very quick. Another method that is a little bit slower onset, lasts a little bit longer, is something called a tincture, which is the active ingredients in marijuana, THC and CBD, dissolved in very small amounts of alcohol, given usually in drops under the tongue. Takes a little bit longer to take effect, lasts a little bit longer, but easier to titrate the dose than the third method, which is common, and that is edibles. So marijuana-infused brownies or gummy bears or pretty much everything else you can imagine. That's often a very socially acceptable way to use medical marijuana because it's just a matter of eating a gummy bear. And that works for many people. It has a long period of action, takes a while to phase in, takes a while to phase out. Some people like that and find it's helpful. Other people find it frustrating because they're never quite sure how much they're getting. And there's always a risk that if you don't see an effect, you might try some more and then some more, and those effects begin to stack up, and then you wind up getting too much.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends on what you're looking for and how you're using it and why.
You address this in the book, too. What about eating it like a salad or infusing it in, I don't know, an olive oil like you would a garlic or something?
So, yes, other approaches. The first, eating it as a salad, doesn't really work for some odd reasons. When THC and CBD exist in the natural environment, they exist in an acidic form, so-called THCA and CBDA, and that acidic form is not biologically active. So you might eat a salad made of marijuana. I have no idea what that tastes like, but if you do, you could absorb those acidic forms, but they wouldn't do anything to activate them. THC and CBD, they need to be either dried or heated or both, which is why most people, when they smoke marijuana, the buds are dried and then heated. You mentioned olive oil. I got a great recipe along the way from a guy who owns a dispensary in California whose wife, he says, makes really, really good linguine and clam sauce with butter that's been infused with marijuana. He offered. I did not take him up on that. The secret, though, to getting THC and CBD out of a marijuana bud and into some other substance is to use either alcohol, like the tinctures I mentioned, or some form of fat, which is usually olive oil or butter. In the book, actually, I include what somebody claimed to me is the world's best and easiest brownie recipe, and that involves heating marijuana buds in a fairly large quantity of butter to try to get those THCs and CBD soluble in the fat, the butter, and then using the butter to make brownies.
Very quickly, before we go to a break and then come back, Katie on our Facebook page thinks it should be legalized also for recreational use. She's had sleeping problems. I've used marijuana in the past. It's relieved my anxiety and sleeplessness, she writes on our Facebook page, as well as lowered my blood pressure. My only side effect, I was tired. Sleeplessness, can it help there? A lot of people with chronic sleeplessness.
Definitely, and I met a lot of people who are using it for that reason. The best evidence, again, in terms of limited randomized controlled trials, the best evidence for sleeplessness comes from using marijuana among people who have other problems. So people who have, say, severe neuropathic pain use marijuana, their pain improves, and then they sleep better. So it's difficult to tell whether marijuana by itself would help people to sleep. I mean, based on the side effects that people see, I think it's very, very, very reasonable to assume that it would. So reasonable, you almost wonder whether you actually need a randomized controlled trial to determine that marijuana makes you sleepy. So I think there's a high likelihood that it does, and certainly many people use it for that reason.
Palliative care physician Dr. David Kasseret with us live this hour. His new book, Stoned, A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana. He's a researcher, also professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Music. He set out for a couple years to find evidence of marijuana's medical potential. Join us with your question or comment, 1-866-780-9100. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk or find us on Facebook. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with more of River to River with Dr. David Kasseret in just a moment. So good to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with palliative care physician Dr. David Kasseret live this hour. His book, Stoned, A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana. Dr. Kasseret is a researcher, also professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. For this book, he set out to find evidence of marijuana's medical potential, also to find out what are the risks. Basically, what is the medical value of marijuana? How much do we know about it? How much of it is undiscovered? Is it safe, or at least as safe as other drugs that a doctor might prescribe? You can join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Quite a bit of activity on Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page as well. This comment from Autumn: with research, we can understand dosage and effects just like any other medical research. I know people who have used medical marijuana for menstrual pain, depression, eating disorders, and many others. A friend of mine just had an invasive procedure done at the Mayo Clinic to help diagnose and deal with her seizures when medical marijuana could have helped her and saved her so much money. You can go to our Facebook page. Put in your question, your comment, your experience. Let's go to one of our callers. Ray is on the line, calling from Colorado Springs, in a state where also the recreational use of marijuana is legal. Ray, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks a lot. Just want to answer a few of your questions that you had on the Facebook page. As far as the risk, as far as the health risk.
Well, we have our physician here to do that. Do you have a question for our physician?
No, I have multiple sclerosis. Mm-hmm. I've been a lobbyist in Iowa since 2006, and I'm what's called a Colorado refugee. I live here in freedom with a change in society to a positive. What's going on in Iowa is what's called the fear of the unknown. And you had a question, what are the risks? There's no health risks to any human using marijuana. The risk in Iowa is jail and getting some bad medicine or getting ripped off or getting killed.
Okay.
Good day.
Well, Ray, thank you. We'll take that question very seriously, as does Dr. Kasseret in his book. You do look at the downsides. Is Ray correctly? Does that match up with what you found, the downsides?
Well, I think it's a great question. I think it's close. So there are, I think, risks to medical marijuana, and that shouldn't be an indictment of medical marijuana. There's no risk, no medication, either over-the-counter or by prescription, that doesn't have risks. All medications have risks. For marijuana, some of the risks that I think are most significant include the obvious, but it's worth mentioning, and that's it impairs people's ability to drive, probably as much, if not more, than alcohol does. Again, not an indictment. Alcohol is certainly legal, but it is a risk that people need to be counseled on. The other big risk, and this was actually a surprise to me, was the risk of addiction. And again, not an indictment of medical marijuana. Nicotine is addictive. Alcohol is addictive. Certainly legal drugs like morphine are addictive. But addiction in marijuana is definitely a real phenomenon. And it was a surprise to me. I never really thought of marijuana as being addictive. But dependence, addiction are real, as is a withdrawal syndrome.
Mm-hmm. Well, you also address the evidence or lack of evidence. What about brain damage, the way it changes or damages our brains if used over the long term, perhaps used from a person at a very young age? Also mental illness thrown into this as well. What evidence did you find there about long-term damage possibly?
It's a great question. It's really hard to make sense of all the studies that have been done. I think the best summary that I could give you, and which I tried to summarize for readers of the book, is that there may be some evidence that long-term use changes a brain's structure and might interfere at least somewhat with thinking and memory. That sounds pretty scary by itself. So there are a couple of caveats to that. One is that those changes are often changes that show up on an MRI scan or neuropsychological testing that may be totally invisible to an individual. So they may be changes, they may be deficits, they may be problems, but they might be invisible. The other problem with all the studies that I've seen that have been done is they're all studies of recreational users. So this might be somebody who started using marijuana when she was 12 years old, used it for 20 plus years, often with other drugs like cocaine or heroin or crystal, and it becomes really hard to figure out whether if she, at the age of 45, has some evidence of brain changes or problems in thinking, was that due to the marijuana or the other things that she's used. So we really don't know. I think there's probably enough theoretical evidence to be at least a little bit concerned, but I don't think right now enough evidence to be panicked, especially for people using it for medical purposes. You know, an administrative assistant at the University of Iowa in Iowa City who uses a marijuana edible twice a week to help her get to sleep. I mean, is she really going to have brain damage in 20 years? I kind of doubt it.
Okay, let's go to callers. We have plenty of callers for Dr. David Kasseret, also author of Stoned, A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana. Dinah in Iowa City. Hello, Dinah.
Hello there. I'm calling because I wanted to comment on the use of marijuana for neurological pain. I just recently experienced shingles, which is really painful, and I found that marijuana was the most effective painkiller with very few side effects. I'd also used codeine, but codeine wasn't my first choice because of unpleasant side effects. I just felt like just a few puffs of marijuana, and I would be pain-free for at least several hours. So I was just wondering if the doctor has heard of any anyone else using marijuana for shingles pain.
Okay, thank you. It's Dina. I'm sorry if I mispronounced your name the first time off. Dina in Iowa City. Does this fall in the category of neuropathic pain you were talking about, Dr. Kasaret?
Yeah, it certainly does. That's exactly it. That's actually probably the classic example of neuropathic pain. And I have not seen randomized controlled trials. But there are so many uses that fall into this category of uses of medical marijuana that are plausible, have some theoretical basis, but haven't been tested by clinical trials and probably won't for a while. I actually got together with some students here at the University of Pennsylvania to create a website, www.marijuanaresults.org. It's still in very preliminary stages now, but we started a couple of days ago a Kickstarter campaign to try to get funding to build the site up for exactly the reason that Dina suggested. She's had this experience. It seems to work for her. She wants to know whether other people out there have had similar experiences. There's really no way that we can crowdsource some of the evidence about medical marijuana. So we're hoping if we can get Kickstarter funding for this site, it'll be a place where patients can go, can share their own stories, can learn about the stories for other people, and most critically for me, thinking about the future, a place where researchers can go and say, wow, we've got 20, 30, 40, 50 reports of people using marijuana for shingles. Maybe we should do a randomized control trial.
Okay. Thank you, Dina from Iowa City, for raising the question of shingles and possibly being helped by medical marijuana. Diane, also from Iowa City. Hi, Diane. What's your take on this?
Hi. My mother died of pancreatic cancer a few months ago. And when we found out about her diagnosis, we were very worried about pain control. And we use medical marijuana in the form of tincture and in suppositories. We use children's Tylenol to put in the THC, the hemp oil, in that. And it was a godsend for us. We didn't have to use – she was able to communicate with us for 3 months and had some really nice times with us. And if we put her on hospice with morphine, we would have lost her immediately. Mm. So, you know, everything they say about these side effects and things like that, we just looked at all the drugs that they were giving my mother before we started medical marijuana. Take a look at the side effects with those drugs. Mm-hmm. They're incredible.
Diane, thank you for sharing your story, and we're very sorry for the loss of your mother.
Thank you.
Dr. Kasaret, you are a palliative care physician. You work in the hospice area. In the area of hospice, how do you find medical marijuana being most beneficial in this type of pain relief without the morphine sort of blurring your mind and thoughts and able to communicate?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Clear for the record, I live and practice in the state of Pennsylvania where medical marijuana is not legal. So the patients I've spoken with for this book come almost entirely from other states, with the exception of a few patients who are using it illegally. I've been surprised by the number of people, both near the end of life, as the caller's mother was, as well as people who are young, relatively healthy, except for one or two chronic conditions, who turn to medical marijuana partly to find relief, but also to get away from the side effects of opioids, but other drugs as well. I tell the story of one woman who suffered a back injury. Developed neuropathic pain after a workplace accident. She wasn't getting relief from the opioids like OxyContin that she was on. They were making her feel stupid and slow and giving her nausea, and they weren't really helping her. So she really turned to medical marijuana to get off of opioids. So whenever people talk about people abusing medical marijuana or trying to get high, I always remind them that may be true for some people, but some people are actually trying to get away from drugs like opioids that are clearly addictive to use medical marijuana instead to avoid those side effects.
Let's talk a little bit before our hour gets away from us. We'll go back to callers in just a moment. What do you feel is needed in terms of research to get done what needs to be done? So many open questions and mysteries I hear behind your answers. Well, what needs to happen for us to have a better handle on the possible benefits of medical marijuana and have a good scientific basis?
Well, I think two big changes or developments. One is something I alluded to a few minutes ago, which is crowdsourced research. I mentioned the Kickstarter campaign for marijuanaresults.org. I mean, that's a way to learn from all of the people who are using medical marijuana now. We might as well be learning something from them. I think the other big change that's needed that will be harder to implement, frankly, is for the federal government to rethink the current scheme of scheduling marijuana as a Schedule I drug. As long as it's a Schedule I drug, it's going to be very, very difficult to do research. It's also going to be almost impossible for the federal government to fund therapeutic research. And the federal government really is the main funder for most research in this country after the pharmaceutical industry. And so if the federal government is not funding therapeutic medical marijuana research, it will continue to languish. Other countries may do this research, but we won't be able to. So that's also going to have to happen. I don't know how likely that is, honestly. I'd like to see it happen, but I don't know.
What about specific research on the effects on children? We talked about helping children with seizures. We had a caller to that effect. And, of course, medications are divided up when we get them over the counter or by prescription, dosages for children or adults. What about the research on children here in this case?
I think certainly for seizures, as we discussed before, we need that research. And as I mentioned, there's a clinical trial going on now in New York, which, from what I've heard, has had no trouble enrolling parents enrolling their kids. There are a lot of parents who really want to both advance the science and then help their children. There are, unfortunately, a lot of other common conditions that affect kids related to abnormalities of development or inherited metabolic order disorders, many of which come with pain and other symptoms. I mean, I'm an adult physician, so many of the patients, with one or two exceptions I spoke with, were adults. I think if you were to talk to a pediatrician, my guess would be that they would see lots of opportunities, not necessarily for marijuana research per se, but many opportunities for improved symptom management for the kids that they take care of.
Let's go back to our phones. Shelley is joining us, listening in Muscatine. Hi, Shelley.
Hi.
Go ahead,
please.
Good
afternoon.
Good afternoon to you.
Thank you so much. I'm a registered nurse. I'm a certified cannabis nurse here, and I'm the only one here in Iowa. And what I did want to just kind of mention, I'm listening to everything you're saying, doctor, but I haven't heard you discuss the entourage effect and whole plant medicine. And especially in our seizure kids, they actually do need that little bit of THC, not just a straight CBD oil, to have the full benefit in the seizure relief. And I just want to know what your take on whole plant medicine would be in the entourage effect.
Okay, Shelley, thank you. Entourage effect, doctor?
That's a great question. And what Shelley's referring to is, I'll give you an example, and that is that two of the main cannabinoids, as we've talked about, are THC and CBD. There was a lot of interest 20, 30 years ago in trying to extract the active ingredient in medical marijuana. And some researchers thought, all right, it's THC. THC is what marijuana does when it's effective. And so they extracted THC, learned how to synthesize it. It's now marketed under the trade name Marinol. The generic name is Dronabinol. And it really doesn't do much. It doesn't do much at all. It's been effective in clinical trials, but clinically I haven't seen many benefits, and patients hate it because it makes them feel funny but doesn't offer any relief. And that, for a lot of people, both patients, physicians, and researchers, has been a pretty good hint of what Shelley's suggesting, that it may not be as easy as figuring out what the main ingredient of marijuana is. Maybe there are multiple ingredients, and maybe you need some combination of THC and CBD and maybe other less prevalent cannabinoids. So the trial that I know of that's going on for seizures is, I think, CBD only. But there is a company called GW Pharmaceuticals that's marketing a drug called Sativex, which is a mix of both THC and CBD. And that research is driven by this belief that, you know, maybe it's not CBD, maybe it's not THC alone, maybe it's a combination. We're just beginning to understand what that might look like. But me personally, I believe that there are a lot of situations where you probably need both or a balance. And if you only focus on one, you may get lucky and get an effect, but you may be missing a lot of opportunities too.
Back to the downsides you mentioned in your book, possible problems with using medical marijuana. You address the question of overdosing. Is it possible to overdose on marijuana?
Yes and no. It's possible to overdose in the sense that you can have too much. You can feel goofy. You can feel confused. You can certainly feel anxious. As I tell a story in the book, it's also possible, uncommonly, but possible to hallucinate. So those are all symptoms of an overdose. One important reminder, though, for everybody is you can't fatally overdose. So there aren't THC or CBD receptors in the brainstem, which controls breathing. So you can't have a fatal overdose of marijuana in the same way that you could have a fatal overdose of, say, Valium or morphine or heroin or OxyContin.
Mm-hmm. So an overdose in marijuana would be hallucinating, anxiety, extreme anxiety?
Right.
What advice would you give for someone who is looking, we want to have safe drugs if you're going to use this in medical marijuana? How do you know the source you have is safe?
Well, you know, people ask me whether I'm in favor of legalizing medical marijuana and why. And your question alludes to the why piece. That although I'm not convinced that medical marijuana is a wonder drug, I'm convinced it has some benefits. The big reason for me to think seriously about legalization is because it allows testing. And there are some states like Colorado that have mandated testing. So my understanding is that if you buy medical marijuana in Colorado, and I think now recreational marijuana, you can have a guarantee that whatever you're buying from a licensed dispensary has been tested. You know exactly how much THC it has, how much CBD it has, other cannabinoids too, and you can be assured that it doesn't have fungus or bacteria or pesticides or any other contaminant. And that, to me, is an essential part of any medical marijuana legalization, being sure that you're getting what you think you're getting and you're not getting stuff that you shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm. What do you see overall in the future for marijuana? Things have changed dramatically in the last 5 or 10 years in terms of attitudes, also in terms of laws in various states in the United States. Where do you expect us to be in another 5 or 10 years?
To some degree, I think it's going to depend on whether we get more clinical evidence and what that evidence shows. You know, one way this could play out certainly is that more states legalize medical marijuana. There are more clinical trials. Those clinical trials are positive or promising, and the medical marijuana movement continues to gain steam. You know, the other possibility is that we'll do more clinical trials. Many of them will be negative. The pendulum will swing in the other direction, and people will become much more skeptical about the benefits of medical marijuana, which is possible. I mean, we're making a lot of legal decisions right now based on a fairly small number of studies. That, I guess, will be determined, the ultimate outcome, as to whether recreational marijuana becomes legal.
So much territory covered during this hour, much more in your book, Stoned, A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana. Where could a person turn to for reliable advice about using marijuana for an ailment, good quality science-based findings if someone wanted to increase their knowledge?
Well, it would be self-serving if I suggested a book called Stone.
I just mentioned that, yeah,
marijuana.
Right, of course.
Just one hypothetical option. The other place I've seen a lot of patients I spoke with who got advice were from medical marijuana dispensaries. There are certainly some dispensaries that are simply out to make a buck, but other dispensaries, if you happen to live in a state where it's legal, there's some dispensaries who take this stuff really, really seriously, with people who are well-trained, who probably know more about medical marijuana than most doctors do. So the other advice would be to not just read a good book, but also to find a dispensary that you know and trust, who can work with you and knows not just what you need, but knows your preferences and what's important to you.
Dr. David Kasseret is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine, a palliative care physician, also a researcher, and author of the new book, Stoned, A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana. Dr. Kasseret, a lot of interest in our audience on this topic, and we want to thank you for joining us this hour.
Thanks very much. It was my pleasure.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.